Audible Inc. presents Lonesome Animals, written by Bruce Hulbert, narrated by Bruce Hulbert.
Prologue. There was, even in Russell Strahl's time, the myth of the strong, silent man of the West. The reverse was closer to the mark. Geography and miles keep people few and far between, even in settled times. Their minds combat the silence and isolation inherent in such spaces by supplying their own narrative. The sound fills the waking hours and intrudes upon any dream they might recall. The remoteness in their gaze, the hesitance in responding to any word put to them, is neither contemplation nor the weight of seriousness nor peace nor solitude nor even alienation upon their souls. It is the jar of another's words piling into the torrent of their own. For 10 years preceding his marriage, Strahl policed the upper Okanagan country. In that time, he arrested 138 Indians, 97 white men, and one woman, who nearly shot his hat from his head as he tried to talk her out of a pistol. He killed 11 men in flight because the circumstances made returning them alive too much trouble. 3 others he killed returning fire, and 1 he beat into a moron with a blacksmith's hammer. He deposited his checks directly into the army bank, and that kept him from drinking them up in the early days, though after 1 year, the work occupied him more than any tavern might. The Lord above filled the holes in the Sunday morning believers. The law began to do the same for Strahl. Strahl could smell a guilty man, perhaps because the odor was familiar. He could predict which rise he might pursue for his stand because he himself would have chosen the same. In a person's face, he recognized the seat of acts before he who owned it might. Among the stories told about him are those in which he announced to a suspect hoping to disappear in the hollow of a thicket, "You are considering the distance between yourself and the brush and whether I can get around into you before you reach it. It is a good bet for you, nearly 50-50. And once you are in the trees, well, your luck may hold for who knows how long. But then I will kill you instead of arrest you, which is simpler for me and requires no paperwork or trial. It's up to you. If you have a weapon, you might even get around into me, though no one has managed yet. And if you have a brain in your head, you know who I am." And the pursued would consider his chances while Strahl opened his revolver and spun the cylinder to make certain each round remained in its place. He would likely fire 1 into the terrain above, raining dirt upon his man. Then he would linger silently, ignoring the conversation his suspect might employ to buy time or stave off boredom. Most instances, less than 5 minutes and his man would surrender his weapon from the brush. Strahl would treat him kindly with the cuffs and rope and help him to his mount if he possessed one. Some took hours, however. Strahl ate his supper and smoked cigarettes, then let the governor drink from the coffee pot. If it was cold, he'd build a fire as pitchy as fuel as he could find. A few patient enough to manage twilight threw insults at him as the light thinned upon the horizon. In the early days, he prepared for such contingencies by keeping the wind at his back, then lighting anything between himself and his quarry that took a match. Or, if the ground was steep and the country right, he would lever boulders free with a bar and roll them onto the suspect's position. Later in his career, waiting lost its capacity to entertain him, and after 1 hour he grew annoyed and threw army surplus hand grenades or smoke ordnance to move the conversation forward. His facility to stash his heart and soul in a saddlebag and his man's inability to do the same separated him from his prey. There was little human in it. Strahl believed the state of every mind was thus, and he saw it as the central truth around which every man orbited, not considering the possibility that the star that held him in its gravity may not be a star at all, but a black planet, and he a trivial moon circling it. The moments when Strahl crashed against a door and spilled into a room or knelt under a pine shadow outside a fire's fitful light, every second belonged to itself and what occurred within it either informed the next or did not. Some appeared to blend like a painting's oils, a pleasant serendipity, while others existed apart as those on the palette, the same colors, a useless collision of time and reason. Justice was just a coincidence within the bedlam. A moment that, when separated from the whirlwind, turned simple enough to take on fairness's guise. Prosecutors would argue the malice in a thunderbolt. Defense attorneys, the inevitable forces of the jet streams and barometric pressure and condensation and topography. Given the proper atmosphere, a tornado resided in each of us. Only our circumstances differed. Sympathetic as the latter's pain and damage might be in an acquaintance, a judge and gavel encouraged an ordinary person toward clarity. Jurors will avail themselves of any opportunity to hunt meaning in the dying winds and withdrawing rain inside a courtroom. Strahl had witnessed them rule more than one innocent man guilty just for the reprieve from the moral ambiguity outside the courtroom walls. Strahl, however, remained in the comfort of the storm, and he thought himself content. When a woman, the only one Strahl ever desired beyond the natural stirrings flesh is slave to, pierced that narrative for a time, it seemed evidence that nature, judgment, and good fortune had finally taken Strahl's side. Women were not foremost in his thoughts. Church girls tended soldiers' barracks, and on occasion the grocer's daughter, Emma Everett was her name, visited Strahl's billet to open the windows and trade out the bedding. She had a fine, straight nose and long, dark hair and possessed little of the formality that set him off most women. She approached him in September. The air was heavy with dust and harvest chaff holding the light. She wore a long dress, thin enough to reveal the shadow of her legs in the lowering sun. "Would you enjoy a hale and hearty walk?" she asked him. "I traipse around all day long," he said. She cocked her head and blinked her eyes at him, then puffed up her lower lip like a child. She extended her hand. He stood but didn't take hers, so she slipped it under his elbow. Dust cloaked half her face, and in the shadows he enjoyed her nose and thin lips and teeth slightly bent inward in a manner that old women used to say came from keeping on the tit too long. On a bluff that overlooked China Bend, he sat in the damp grass and listened to the crickets rake their bellies. Emma bent to one knee with him. Her shoes were within his reach. He wanted to bend and clean them with his handkerchief. "I'm working at the grocery," Emma said. "I see nearly everyone in the county except you. Would it slay you to stop in once in a while?" "The commandant does most of the shopping," Strahl said. Her brow creased and she frowned. "I'm not much for conversation." "Is it because people lie to you in your job?" Emma asked. "I have heard some whoppers," Strahl chuckled. "Words turn just noise after a while. I suppose if a house were burning, fire might be handy, but not nearly as much as a bucket of water." "So those books on your bedstand, they must raise quite a din when you open them." Strahl loved books. They were closed loops. He wondered if she was poking fun at him. "Why'd you haul me up here?" Strahl asked. "Because I didn't think you would." She bent and kissed him, and her face erased the sky. She closed her eyes, and her face turned blank as a piece of paper waiting for his writing. He held her head in his hand, pleased with the weight, then put his face to hers, and their lips clobbered awkwardly. A drop of blood stained one of her front teeth. She kissed him again, and he tasted her blood in his mouth. Afterwards, he gazed down at the clear part in her hair and the white skin in her forehead and her nose beneath. She turned her head up to his, and he set his lips to hers. She parted her mouth like she was drinking water from a stream, and he felt his do the same. Emma took one of his hands and laced both hers over it. He clamped her wrists and pulled her toward him until she was stretched enough to kiss. Sweat stung his scalp, her nose flared and her lungs filled. He found her dress buttons with his fingers. Hers fluttered on the backs of his hands like tiny birds. "Oh," she said, "oh." He stared at her breasts loose underneath her camisole. "I don't know what to do," he said. She took his hand. "Please don't think I do. Know what to do, I mean." "I will think whatever you want me to," Strahl said. She laughed a little. "Not knowing. That's better than flowers or ribbon or perfume, really." The second year of his marriage, Strahl tracked a bad half-breed for a month. The man's path included a girl not more than 14, raped with a tree branch, and another, only a little older, beaten near to death, then violated with a broken pool cue. His third woman, he took abreast as a trophy. The first woman had been conscious enough to offer a fair description: brown hair cut with bangs in the front, a mustache, wiry strong. The second added he blinked too much. Even the third, in death, contributed the bloody red handkerchief that a man named Reynolds, who fit the rest of the descriptions, was known to favor. Straw found him at the Red Garter in Coulee Dam, sharing a pitcher of beer with two ranch hands between alfalfa cuttings. Straw shot out Reynolds' knees in the chair where he sat. The ranch hand scurried under a pool table. Straw approached Reynolds, stepped on his wrist, and put another bullet through his palm, and then did the same to the other, leaving the ring finger dangling. Finally, he hauled Reynolds by the ankles outside where he tied him to his horse and fired a round into the air. The horse bolted over the steep, paved road, Reynolds' head whacking the asphalt each step. When the horse tired, Straw shot into the sky again, and the horse barreled onto the highway where he was fortunate enough to dodge a freight truck. No luck saved Reynolds, however, whose head smashed like a melon under the Studebaker's wheels. For 2 months following, nearly every morning, Straw and Emma woke to cut flowers on their doorsteps or fruit breads or a string of clean trout or a calf's liver. Emma cooked or sliced each gift from the porch and invited neighbors to meals, serving them grand dinners that she allowed Straw to enjoy by carrying the conversation, occasionally hauling him by calloused hand into the kitchen where she shut the door and hooked the lock under the hoop and tongue-kissed him and banged her hips into his until both their faces flushed with ardor. 7 weeks later, he encountered a pervert suspect on a Nespelum street. The man drew his weapon like he was Jesse James himself, and Straw twisted out of the bullet's path behind an elm. The pervert let off another round. Straw saw it leave the barrel and the smoke following it. He dropped to one knee and heard the bullet thump into the withers of an Appaloosa broodmare tied to the livery post. The horse reared and dragged the shop's porch into the street. Straw rested his right wrist on his left and squeezed his pistol's trigger. The bullet took the man's testicles from his lingam. His pants leaked blood like he pissed himself red, and both hands covered his plumbing like he might still mend. Straw belted the man's pistol and removed a knife and razor from his pockets, then walked to the stockade where he ate a late lunch and afterwards sent a pair of corporals to collect the man, who lived to stand trial and serve 23 years in Walla Walla, breaking granite to gravel to pave farm roads. One of the girls the man had victimized stopped by a week later with a jar of apricot jelly. "I slept 3 nights in a row now," she told him. He said nothing, but Emma cried, and that night she pulled him to her like a hungry she-wolf and didn't turn loose until the moon crossed half the sky. Straw fell close to heroic. Emma informed him she was pregnant 6 weeks later, and he felt he had arrived in a strange country that he'd set out for but never expected to reach. Someone invited him to join a church. Emma was included in a fashionable quilting circle, and the commandant suggested Straw spend more time at his desk. He put his savings into a plot of land across the river, and Emma began sketching house plans. His daughter arrived healthy, and they named her Dorothy, though she would soon become Dot. Emma clucked and hummed to the baby all hours, but to Straw the child turned frustration. He found no edge to an infant he could grasp, and she became as foreign to him as the moon. Narrative could not reside in such routines, though, despite the fact most of living did. Straw's wife knew his twisting his hands and worrying the windows for what they were, foreshadows of an escape from her and his daughter for his work. They were no more interesting than a field to him. A description of a man and a litany of his crimes, though, made for a story that he, in those days of righteousness and ignorance, could end and rely upon as argument that the world contained patterns and logic, and if not justice, then at least retribution. The habit, however, required being alone, and the isolation drove his mind into a skull like a muscle into a shell. In his isolation, he concluded each person ground the gristle and meat of his days and events and emotions into a meal he could feed himself and not feel empty. A person's worth came down to his talents as a butcher. Some cut and bone their hours and years without reckoning and wondered why they encountered blood at all, while others acknowledged themselves as the source of both the killing and the sausage. He was mistaken, of course. When he was assigned what would eventually be called the Box Canyon Massacre, he had not yet surrendered his ignorance or his bliss. Box Canyon was north, and north was a direction like hell was a place. Property lines and boundaries between counties or countries remained rumors. No one knew where up north started and where it left off, but they were certain that it held all that white people feared and the little left they didn't understand. Any disturbance that remained a mystery beyond a month, the Army relegated to that particular compass point, and when county and state police took up the Army's duties, they found it just as handy. Strahl had apprehended men in the North Country, which was filled with mountains and trees and rock you found in any other direction. The only difference was later spring and earlier fall and a few wolves and panthers. The Indians knew this, but the BIA cops still attributed crimes they themselves were accessories to or those that they were too indolent to investigate to that bearing. The Box Canyon massacre took place neither in a box canyon nor was it a massacre. A family of Methow, with no reputation for trouble, left the reservation to pick huckleberries in the Okanagan foothills. A cattle rancher named Doring accosted the spindly group as they crossed his rangeland. The Indians quickly agreed to divert along the county road. The rancher, though, being German, possessed a bit of the Hun, and he shot the old grandfather who spoke for them in the shoulder. Horses reared and riders fell, and in the melee the rancher broke his neck against a tree stump, and his straw boss's thigh took a bullet, likely from Doring's rifle, facts would later determine. The Doring widow, however, insisted it was murder, and the superintendent of police summoned Strahl to clear it up. The Madhouse knew enough of military justice to recognize their best chance lay in the high timber. They bolted for the deepest country in that portion of the state, north of the Aeneas and beyond the Kettle River toward Curlew and the Canadian border. Severe as a steeple, all except the frost line remained canopied with pine and birch and aspen and tamarack, making tracking dark and humid even midday. Add to that the carpet of ferns and brush that grew in such habitat, and it was slow travel. It took Strahl 6 days to close on the group, enough to hear them, and another 2 days for the sighting. They labored across a trail that led around Chisaw Mountain, bearing their belongings on packboards in a travoy. Above and below, sheer granite cliffs sparkled like fresh water. Strahl worked himself ahead of them at the foot of a talus slide. When they were within his sight once more, he fired a warning shot into the rocks above, as was his habit, when he wanted to stop a suspect he knew was already afraid. The gun belched sulfur and a smoke wisp, and the report echoed against the rock. A second of silence passed, one that, looking back, should have made him uneasy, as the women should have at least shouted in surprise. A rush of stones followed. One tumbled through the trees 100 feet below, scalping saplings and bushes in its path. An old woman wailed. The family had bolted in their fear and collapsed a soft part of the trail, Strahl surmised. As he approached the little band, he saw checked shirts and wool blankets scattered among the rocks, along with stockings and unmatched shoes. 10 feet beneath the trail, he discovered the father and his son, half buried with stones. "How did this happen?" Strahl asked. The old woman flexed her finger as if she were pulling a trigger. "I didn't shoot them," Strahl said. The old woman shook her head. She pointed to the rocks above. "God damn it, that's not what I intended," Strahl shouted at her. The woman looked at him as if he were a tornado or a thunderbolt or a killing freeze. Strahl removed the stones covering the bodies. The father's skull was a leaking gourd and his shirt spattered with his own gray brains. A boulder had blasted the boy's chest with such force it parted his ribs and sternum and tore a strap of flesh 1 foot wide and twice that long. Under, his heart and part of a lung sucked for air and floundered until they ceased their toil. Suddenly a girl cried out in Salish and scurried from the trees beneath them, half naked, dotted with welts. She raced through the stones and fell upon a pack, tearing at the rawhide straps. Strahl had prepared for her to rise with a gun, but she held in her hand instead only a skinning knife. Relieved, he cried out in her language to put it away. She blinked at him, understanding the words but not how they could come from him. Then she drew the blade across her throat. Blood arced from an artery and the scarlet spray pocked her skin and the rocks beneath her. She dropped to one knee. The blood poured from her like she'd opened a spigot. By the time he reached the girl, it was thick as syrup. Strahl sat on a flat rock and watched her die. He was too weary to speak. He remained where he was through the day's heat and into the cool evening. He possessed no compass to direct him from this place and no heart to beat blood into his muscles and press him forward if he had. He carried the bodies into a draw finally, where the dirt was softer. There he dug 3 graves. He let the old woman sing, then filled them. It was nightfall when he finished. He offered the woman passage back, making it clear she would ride his mount. But she was determined to stay, and he could produce no convincing argument otherwise in her language or his own. Rumor in the Box Canyon newspaper reports cemented Strahl's reputation with criminals and the general public alike. And though those opinions originally diverged, time would eventually wind them into a braid. 10 days later, Strahl cooked breakfast, as he did each morning he wasn't pursuing suspects. The skillet snapped with Polish sausage, and he added 3 eggs. Emma puttered behind him, organizing canisters and setting the table. The child slept. Ordinarily, it would have been a sweet moment for them. Yet, when he asked Emma for the peppermill and she dallied to finish lining the napkins with silverware in the proper order, Strahl clanked the pan with the metal spatula and said, "The pepper." Emma crossed her eyes at him testily, and he lifted the cast iron skillet, sausage and all, and drove it into the side of her head. Sausages scattered across the floor, and grease, blood, and cerebral fluid clotted her hair and streaked her face. She staggered, blinked her eyes at him, then collapsed onto her side and seized. Strahl took her head in his hands and watched her pupils black to hazel from her eyes. The child, 4 years old, fussed in the other room, then found a toy and quieted, until a neighbor shielded her eyes and packed her away. Emma breathed for 2 more days, then did not. Strahl confessed to the commandant and insisted on a trial in prison. The commandant wrote Emma's death up as an accidental fall and ordered her buried without an investigation. He promoted Strahl to captain, but Strahl resigned his commission the next day and remained AWOL throughout the remainder of his stint, taking contracts on men from the state and later the feds. He put Dot in his bed and she slept under his unfurled arm, but he did not rest. The third day he farmed her out to the most pleasant neighbors and soon was absent entire seasons, just his bedroll and Isaac Stevens. He could tolerate only silence for weeks at a time, though it wasn't the kind conferred upon so many men a generation younger than he, who drew their stoic qualities from dime store novels and picture shows. Strahl's stillness was not a heroic choice. It contained nothing resembling assurance or calm. It was its opposite, a smoking, frozen bewilderment, or, when driven past tolerance, a mustering of power so unhinged from will or belief, so purely sired in what was before him and his blindness to it, as to be monstrous. It seemed to him he'd gotten living backward, that the years were stealing wisdom from him rather than delivering it. He recognized what anyone in police work must. In even the most virtuous life, anarchy lay, like a live round, bolted and chambered, and at any moment the firing pin could fall upon the casing and thrust the spinning lead in any direction. Those years, the only words he heard directed him toward his man or lied to steer him awry. Traveling aboard a breathing animal, he matched its breath with his own, the only taste in his mouth the remains of a meal from an army tin or something he'd killed an hour before. His mind emptied and filled with all of what surrounded him, and he sought from it nothing but its silence. Yet his ears denied him even this small favor, for no man is permitted that kind of quiet.